I like some of the proposed solutions that's coming from the grassroots level.
You're listening to Making Contact.
I'm Salima Hamarani. Welcome to Making Contact. On today's show, we're airing a piece from our new partner, Current Cultures. That's Ajaj Nuwahid, who was once a host for a radio station based in Jerusalem, back when Palestine was under British mandate.
He stayed in bed most of the time, all on a chair, and then he used to write a little bit, read a lot. He was thinking, of course, and he was dreaming of writing his memoir.
And that's his daughter, Bayan, who recorded his memories of his time at the Palestine Broadcasting Service. And we wanted to air this piece because of what's happening in Palestine right now, but also because the radio station was a sort of capsule for this moment in history, right before Palestine was split into two nations.
So that history gets consolidated or truncated from a multi-language mandate era semi-colonial radio station into a national station that's the Voice of Israel.
Here's Jerusalem Calling. This story originally aired on Kerning Cultures podcast. Kerning Cultures tells stories from across the Middle East and North Africa and the spaces in between. That's Kerning with a K.
Our story today comes from producers Shahid Ben Yaradeh and Alex Atak. Here's Alex.
The inauguration of the radio station, the Palestine Broadcasting Service, or the PBS as we're going to call it, was on March 30th, 1936.
And it was a big deal. There are extant photographs of the time that show that the head of the British government in Palestine was there, lots of other eminent officials. It was presented as a big deal.
This is Andrea Stanton. She's a professor at the University of Denver in Colorado.
And most of my work has been around Arabic language radio. Is that too short? I mean, I can, like most academics, I can go on for
perfect.
A long time.
And Andrea's really the person who held our hand through this story. She wrote a book about the Palestine Broadcasting Service called This is Jerusalem Calling.
It was really kind of an amazing sense of responsibility. Obviously, it's not my personal history.
Anyway, back to that day in March 1936, the inauguration of the radio station in Palestine.
Yes. Okay, well, so to tell you the story of the day of the PBS began broadcasting, I'd probably have to back up a little bit.
Enrico non studia.
Should old acquaintance.
And the Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
In the 1930s, which is the context for the Palestine Broadcasting Service, radio was not totally new, but it was still a pretty hot commodity at the time.
There are a few reasons why Britain wanted to start a broadcasting service in Palestine at the time. After World War I, Britain had a League of Nations mandate to govern Palestine into quote-unquote self-reliance. The population in Palestine around this time, 1936, was made up of around 90% Arabs and other Arabic-speaking minorities, around 10% Hebrew-speaking Jews, and then maybe a couple of hundred British mandate government officials. But the power was balanced in a way that was kind of the opposite of that. I mean, the British mandate government officials, there were, you know, just a handful of them living in Palestine at the time. But they had power over the country. And the first reason that they wanted to set up a radio station in Palestine was because, like, at the time, Europe was seeing this kind of general rise in fascism. 3 years earlier, Hitler had been appointed the Chancellor of Germany. Mussolini's fascist party were gaining popularity in Italy. And so, bouncing around on the airwaves across Europe and into the Middle East, you had these radio stations that were broadcasting, like, all of these various ideologies.
The British government, particularly the Foreign Office, also the Colonial Office and the British Mandate government, was becoming increasingly concerned about what they considered anti-British propaganda coming from an Italian-operated Arabic language station, Radio Bari.
Italia combatte. Questa trasmissione è dedicata ai patrioti italiani che lottano contro i tedeschi.
Some historians refer to this period as the radio wars.
So those stations were of great concern to British politicians. They were of great concern.
So one of the ideas behind the Palestine Broadcasting Service was partly Britain recognizing that they couldn't afford to let like Italian and German propaganda broadcast into the countries that they had mandates over unchallenged. But reason number two was this kind of vague and imperialistic idea floating around at the time that radio stations were a kind of marker of a modern society.
Radio was seen as a public good, but a public good that was supposed to kind of, the phrase that's used at some point is educate and elevate people.
Which I think you can tell a lot about how Britain like saw the citizens of the countries that they had colonized or had mandates over.
The attitudes that British officials in Palestine brought to their understanding of what they called Palestinian peasants, Falahin, it's not a wrong translation, but it comes with a certain amount of baggage, was not particularly different from the way that they also looked at some rural populations in India.
But it was also with a sort of wariness for the people that they were colonizing. Like, if they didn't quote unquote like modernize, which is a grimy word, but if they didn't quote unquote modernize the population, they may be more likely to rise up and destabilize British rule. That was what they thought.
And the concern, if I could put it very, very crudely, is these people are important where they are, and yet they have been left behind by the modern world. And so what radio offers is the chance to bring them gently into the modern world without alarming them, and also without enticing them to leave the farm, leave the rural area, and go to the city where they might become a kind of dangerous proletariat.
But by just existing in the place it existed, it was always going to have a hard time avoiding politics. The PBS was trying to meet the needs of all the communities living in Palestine at the time. Arabs and other Arabic-speaking people, Jews, many of whom spoke Hebrew, and the English-speaking British Mandate government staff. So they set it up like this. The broadcasting day would be split up into three sections: Arabic, Hebrew, and English.
So this is a multi-language broadcasting station with the bulk of the broadcasting time in Arabic, the second largest proportion or the second largest amount of time in Hebrew, and then the smallest amount of time in English.
But almost immediately, the station ran into controversy.
Yes. So this is a great question of what's in a name. So this is the Palestine Broadcasting Station, and it was broadcasting in English, Arabic, and Hebrew. Evidently, one point that hadn't been fully clarified before it went on air was what the call sign would be. Radio stations in this time, including the Palestine station, were not on air all the time. They were not 24/7 stations. They were on air for a few hours, then off, on air for a few hours, then off. And they would switch services within the time that they were on air. So between the Arabic service, the English service, and the Hebrew service. And so I'm highlighting this because every time those things happened, every time the station actually went on air, every time a service switched, the announcer would start with a call. So is this mandate Palestine? Is that going to be the geographical location of the station in the call? Is it going to be the land of Israel? And so this led to pretty quickly a controversy between the Hebrew service and the other services trying to figure out what the name should be. And so that's why it ultimately, the point that everyone could agree on was that the station was based in Jerusalem.
And so that's how the station got, at least on the face of it, a non-controversial call sign that pleased everyone. This is Jerusalem calling. Each day in the morning, that message would be broadcast from the radio tower in Ramallah out over the airways and into homes and cafes around Palestine.
I feel it my duty, as head of the government in Palestine, personally to convey to the peoples of Palestine this resolution, which is of the highest importance.
And on Inauguration Day in March 1936, the British High Commissioner, this guy called Arthur Wauchop, he stood there wearing a tweed suit underneath the brand new broadcasting mast in Ramallah. In front of a Union Jack flag, he gave a speech to mark the inauguration. Quoting from the speech here, "For some years, I've been greatly impressed by the benefits that a well-directed broadcasting service can bring to the mind and the spirit of any people who enjoy its advantages. Broadcasting will be directed for the advantage of all the classes and all the communities. The broadcasting service in Palestine will not be concerned with politics. Its main object will be the spread of knowledge and culture," end quote. The speech was broadcast live, and it became the first thing to ever air on the Palestine Broadcasting Service. What you're hearing now is tape from a later broadcast, But because it was broadcast live, there are hardly any recordings that were preserved. For the hours and hours of the PBS that was broadcast, so little of it survives.
I think it's somewhere between 10 and 15 hours total, just a tiny fraction of the overall life of the station.
So that's around 10 to 15 hours of tape out of an entire 12 years of broadcasting. But it gives us a sense of like what the radio station were broadcasting and what it sounded like at the time. And it had a pretty wide reach. I mean, Andrea told me that she estimates around 50% of the country would have had regular access to the PBS.
It was very well heard, not only in towns, not only in cities, but also in villages.
This is Bayan al-Wahid again.
The radio was the means for everything in our lives. I mean, our childhood and our adolescent as well. We didn't have anything else. When we had the transistor, for example, that was a revolution.
Transistor, by the way, is a type of portable radio.
The transistor was a revolution in the Arab lives. Of course, when they listen to new music, when they have good songs, when they have good programs.
But still, it was a foreign service managed by an occupying power, the British, who plenty of Palestinians were explicitly opposed to. Despite what Arthur Wacop said about the advantages it would bring to all classes and communities, the PBS definitely was not a runaway hit.
The inauguration starts the service at the end of March. There are lots of great expectations. However, the big story happens about less than a month later.
The main case of the Arabs is against the British government policy in Palestine.
Which is the start of the Great Revolt, the Great Strike of 1936 that leads to the kind of great uprisings for the next 3 years.
On favoring the establishment of a national home for Jews, forgot intentionally to safeguard the civil rights of the non-Jewish population.
The Great Revolt was an uprising by Palestinians against British rule. It started in April 1936, so exactly 1 month after the PBS was inaugurated. And it carried on as labor strikes, protests, and some violence until 1939.
And so I think the station had become quite quickly a symbol of British oppression and British rule in Palestine, both for Palestinians and for the growing number of Jewish immigrants moving into the country. And by 1939, it started to become the target of attacks by anti-British Zionist militia or separatist groups.
There was a bomb that was planted under the desk of one of the station offices, and it ended up killing a woman who was a broadcaster who broadcast for the English language Children's Hour, and it also injured one of the Arab Palestinian staff members, and that was in the 1930s. So even from quite early on, even when the staff was able to manage working together, the station itself became a target for attack.
But still, the British saw the radio station as an accomplishment and they wanted to promote it. They started this scheme in the late 1930s where they'd give out radio sets to villages for free as a way to basically broadcast the Mandate government's programming directly into these radio sets every day and so into the homes and cafes of people around the country. I mean, it wasn't like they were doing them a favor. These sets were pre-tuned to stop anyone from using them to tune into anything except the PBS, especially any of the anti-British stations in Italy and Germany. In 1940, someone was actually fined 10 guineas, which was the currency that the British used for tuning into a foreign station.
They could give out as many pre-tuned radio sets as they wanted, right? But they could only get people to actually listen if they had a reason to. So the conclusion they arrived at was to hire well-known Palestinian figures to manage the Arabic side of the station. The first person they hired was a poet from Nablus called Ibrahim Tuqan. He stepped down in 1940, or maybe he was fired or resigned. It's really not exactly clear from the records. And the person that replaced him was Ajaj al-Wahid, Bayan's dad, who seems like he would have been an unlikely choice.
From the beginning, they were against each other, definitely. My father in 1932 published a weekly magazine called Al Arab magazine. And of course, and it was stopped many times, and they threatened him to send it again to jail, so and so and so. They were against each other, definitely.
He was a lawyer by profession, but he was also a member of an anti-British Arab nationalist political party called Al-Istiqlal, or Independence. But around the beginning of the Second World War, as Hitler and Nazi's party were gaining traction, Hajjaj and the British found a space of common ground.
Both of them had interest in helping each other.
World War II had started in 1939, and although they'd been politically opposed in the past, Hajjaj and the British were at least on the same side now, in that they were, you know, both against Hitler and against the Nazis.
Yes, yes. After the Second World War started, a man came and told my father that they asked me to ask you and tell you if you come to be a director of the Arab section, I mean, in the radio of Jerusalem. This is Jerusalem calling. He said, me? How do you ask me? I'm a member of the Istiqlal Party, the Istiqlal Political Party. So we are enemies of the British people and we are against the mandate. How can I accept this?
Bayan told us that he was interested in the idea of it, but he came back to the British with a set of demands and conditions, which Bayan told us were basically, I'm not going to report any news that is biased or unfavorable to Arabs, and I'm not going to be part of your political agenda, and I'm not going to let you censor me.
They said, we accept. Why they accepted, I said it from the beginning, because they needed now a strong man, and they needed one who looks for real democracy and who talks about democracy. Now, it doesn't mean that they were with the British forever, but during the war, yes.
We're just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact, and this piece called Jerusalem Calling from our partner Kerning Cultures. If you'd like more information, please visit us at radioproject.org. And now, back to the show.
So Nouaha, this kind of card-carrying member of an anti-British political party, was now the head of the British Mandate radio station in Palestine. And I mean, it wasn't like he could start explicitly broadcasting anti-British sentiment on the air, but he had this love for culture and the arts, and he brought all of it with him to his job at the radio station. He started to devise a broadcasting schedule that would basically highlight Palestinian and Arab artists and intellectuals and musicians and writers from all around the region in a more meaningful way than they had before.
What you're hearing now is one of the musicians he liked to play the most, Sami Shawa.
He cared very much for music, Arabic music. And all those, the musicians, I mean, they used to play, for example, on violin, even the piano, whatever, guitar, whatever, oud.
And he talks about using the cultural programming as a means to kind of build up what we might call national pride, or really support the kind of development of a Palestinian national identity. So like, news might be what people tuned in for, especially at moments of tension or moments, World War II. I mean, there's a lot going on between 1936 and 48 for which people might have wanted to tune in to listen to the news on a regular basis. But the kind of slow build capillary work of building up identity, building up pride, building up a kind of like common cultural repertoire across the national territory, that's done in the cultural programming. That's done in the entertainment programming. There's also some interesting speculation about maybe the ways that at the level of language.
Most of the British officials who ran the station didn't understand Arabic. So Hajjaj and his colleagues on the Arabic side, they might have been able to subtly broadcast things that weren't exactly in line with British editorial guidelines.
Not exactly evade censorship, but to put in some kinds of call-outs or call-ins to people listening that were supporting a Palestinian nationalist cause.
Yeah, of course. Yani, my father, of course, very well understood that this station was heard in most of the Arab countries. That was something very important. He cared a lot to invite others from outside Palestine and also inside Palestine to talk, to give lectures, to discuss. That was very, very important to him indeed.
Hajjaj worked at the station for years, from the 1940 until 1944. And near the end of his time there, it was clear Germany were losing World War II. So the common ground that Hajjaj had united with the British against the Nazis, that wasn't there anymore. The way Ajaj saw it, the threat of imperialism from the Nazis had gone, but the British mandate hadn't gone away. And in the mid-1940s, it was becoming clearer to Palestinians that the political climate in the country was changing. Given the new circumstances, he didn't want to be part of it anymore, so he resigned.
By the mid-1940s, kind of towards the end of World War II, and as it was clear that Great Britain was going to pull out and leave, and the daily life in Palestine in general, and in Jerusalem maybe in particular, became more and more tangentious and also just more and more difficult. It seems that the relations between staff members were deteriorating, but also as parts of the city got carved up into different security zones, the different sections of the station actually broadcast in from different parts of the city or worked from different parts of the city. 1945 or 1946, there were soldiers from the Arab Legion who were just stationed at the station building all the time to prevent hostile takeovers, and there were a number of...
While I was at the British Library listening to those old reels from the PBS, I found this recording of an attack on the station. So quick heads up, I'm about to play some tape that includes some gunshots. If you'd rather not hear that, skip forward about 30 seconds. It's a few minutes long, and it's just the sound of gunfire in the station offices. It didn't come with any notes, just a name that was attack on the PBS studios. A recording technician must have just left the reel recording before dashing out of the door. Do you know, like, why the station would have been a target?
I can speak speculatively. I think that what we're seeing is what becomes a trend by the 1950s and 1960s, that at most, if you want to take over a government, stage a coup, announce a new regime, then you go after the radio station. And so I think that what we see by the 1940s is that in Palestine, as in other places, there's enough of a sense that the radio station really matters, that it is a kind of sign of government authority, of voice, and if you can take it over, right? It's kind of pointless to take over a newspaper. There's a lot of them, and they're slow. It's a way to get a message out.
But none of these attacks were successful. The station carried on broadcasting right up until 1948. At the time, the British had already made the decision that they were going to withdraw from and abandon all claims to Palestine. A couple of months before, the United Nations had voted on a decision to divide Palestine into two sovereign states. And then, on New Year's Day in 1948, the PBS started their broadcast with this message.
Now, from this ancient city of Jerusalem, whence three great lines of faith spread out to the ends of the earth, we send across the world our greetings for this new year of grace, 1948. To the peoples of the United Nations we send greetings. May their leaders, who hold in their hands the seeds of peace or war, may they face up to the problems of mankind with sincerity and courage, and above all, in a spirit of impartial justice.
We might wonder whether that statement on New Year's Day was a reflection of reality or whether it was like a statement of aspiration.
And it makes me think of the reason that the PBS was started in the first place, to broadcast British propaganda. And on this final New Year's Day address, I mean, this was really no different from that. The British were abandoning all responsibility from what was happening in Palestine and what was happening to Palestinians. But on the radio, all they wanted to talk about was good cheer and bright prospects.
And finally, greetings to the people of Palestine, who in these first few moments of 1948 face a fateful year in the long and troubled history of the Holy Land. Theirs is a great heritage. May they, before this newborn year is out, may they prove worthy of the great traditions of their land and meet each other one by one in tolerance and forbearance, in peace and in goodwill.
It was like they were living in a completely different reality. But the staff at the PBS, the Palestinians and the Jewish staff and the British managers, all working in that office together in Jerusalem, they limped along, as Andrea puts it. They carried on putting out their cultural broadcasts, the music and the talks and the lectures and the dramas.
This must have been a challenging, like, let's say that whole year and a half, all of 1947 through mid-1948, it must have been a pretty anxiety-producing, destabilizing period to live through.
From Palestine, first pictures of the latest bomb outrage. Jewish terrorists blow up the Goldsmith Officers Club in Jerusalem.
The result of the crime, the tragic scene, is like a serious incident during the Blitz.
Total casualties on this one day of violence was 18 dead and 25 injured.
65 deaths are reported. And there is little or no hope of survival for any of the 58 missing. Nearly 50 others were injured.
And to take it back to the radio station to try and manage that on the cultural programming, on the entertainment programming side, and on the news side, especially in terms of the, you know, what news was broadcast and how it was broadcast, must have been very challenging for all people involved.
And then, on May 14, 1948, the last British ship left from the port in Haifa. And that night, everything changed.
At Haifa, the last British troops leave Palestine. The Union Jack was hauled down, and the doors closed for good on the British mandate. Later in the day, Israel's flag was flying over Haifa, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Ben-Gurion, was there for the taking over ceremony.
At midnight on May 15th, 1948, the station was renamed from the Palestine Broadcasting Service to Kul Israel, or Voice of Israel.
It immediately gets renamed the Voice of Israel, Kol Israel. And so that history gets consolidated or truncated from a multi-language mandate era semi-colonial radio station into a national station that's the Voice of Israel.
Which was the name that the Zionist groups had petitioned the British to name the station in the first place. 12 years earlier.
So it is the end of the radio station that I was looking at. It is not the end of the human story, and it's also not the end of the broadcasting story.
So in a way, a lot of the history surrounding the Palestine Broadcasting Service was left behind. That's how Andrea puts it. The PBS headquarters became the Kol Israel headquarters, and the station carried on broadcasting from Jerusalem. The broadcast tower in Ramallah, the one with the Union Jack on the side that the British High Commissioner had stood underneath and given the PBS's first broadcast, that was used as a transmission tower by the Jordanian service when that started in the 1950s. And then in 2001, it was destroyed by the Israeli army.
Ajaj Anwar had lived the rest of his life in Ras El Matin, Lebanon, and he died in 1982, 2 years after Bayan's tapes were recorded. In his home in Lebanon, he rebuilt the library he'd lost in Jerusalem in 1948, but he was never able to go back.
But I want to say something. I don't live in Jerusalem ever since I left it as my city, but it's in my heart always. It's in my thoughts. It's much more than it's in my days to come, in my past and in days coming soon. I never forget it. So it's living with me. Jerusalem is with me always. And this is what I don't have a last image because it's a continuous image.
And that does it for today's show. The story originally aired on Kernan Cultures podcast. Kernan Cultures tells stories from across the Middle East and North Africa and the spaces in between. That's Kernan with a K. If you'd like more information on today's show, please visit us at radioproject.org or leave us a comment on Twitter at @making_contact. On Instagram, we're Making Contact Radio Project. The Making Contact team includes Anita Johnson, Jessica Partnow, Sabine Blazin, and I'm Salima Hamrani. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.